This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Daily Digest. I'm Sharmila Ganesan with T. Xiao Yik and Lim Su An. So before the break, we were talking about the Ulu Muda Forest Complex being gazetted as a state park. And now in relation to our second story, we've had a poll going on Twitter.
Yes, so asking you which of these leaders were most inspiring in leading peaceful social change. Your options. So from people who voted, 42% of you voted Gandhi, 40% of you voted Martin Luther King, 12% of you voted Susan B. Anthony, and 7% of you voted for the Dalai Lama.
Surprising.
So you can continue to take that poll on our Twitter page at BFM Radio. And you can also share your thoughts with us on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899, or you can call us at 7733-2900. So we're talking about this because, you know, when we think of revolutions or regime changes, the images that usually come to mind tend to be of conflict or of violence, certainly. Yep. You know, these are images that we see in the media and on, you know, even in fiction. Mm-hmm. But research actually shows that nonviolent protests are twice as likely to succeed as armed conflict. In fact, historically, nonviolent protests that engage just 3.5% of a population have actually never failed to bring about societal change.
Right. So according to an article in the BBC, nonviolent protests or civil resistance is actually the most effective way of shaping world politics. This is based on the research of political scientist Erica Chenoweth, who studied hundreds of civil resistance and social movements from 1900 to 2006. So these are movements that have focused on attempts to bring about regime change, and campaigns that succeeded because of foreign military interventions were excluded. Meanwhile, a campaign was considered violent if it involved physical harm to people or property or the destruction of infrastructure.
And what her research found was that nonviolent campaigns led to political change 53% of the time, compared to 26% of the time for violent protests. So for example, from the 25 biggest movements they studied, 20% of them were non-violent, and out of these 20 of them were non-violent, and 14 of these were successes. And non-violent campaigns also attracted four times as many participants as the violent ones.
So this actually makes sense when you think about how the average person would react to violence. Mm-hmm. Chenoweth says that non-violent campaigns are more likely to succeed because they can reach out to, I suppose, a broader demographic of people.
Right.
And of course, the more people you get onto the cause, the more severe the disruption that can be caused by the protest. Mm-hmm. So here's Erica Chenoweth at a TED Talk explaining why strength in numbers can be so effective when it comes to protest.
Not everybody wants to take the same chances in life, and many people won't turn up unless they expect safety in numbers. The visibility of many civil resistance tactics like protests allow them to draw these risk-averse people into the fray. Put yourself back in that repressive country for just a minute. Let's say your trusted friend and neighbor comes to you and says, "I know you sympathize with our cause. We're going to have a mass demonstration down the street tonight at 8 o'clock. I hope to see you there." Now, I don't know about you all, but I am not the person who's going to show up at 7:55 and see what's up. I'm probably going to look outside my window at 8:30 and see what's going on. If I see six people congregated there in the square, I'm going to sit this one out. But if I see 6,000 and more coming down the alleyway, I just might join in. My point here is that the visibility of civil resistance actions allows them to attract more active and diverse participation from these ambivalent people. And once they become involved, it's almost guaranteed that the movement will then have links to security forces, civilian bureaucrats, economic and business elites, educational elites, state media, religious authorities, and the like. And those people start to reevaluate their own allegiances. No regime loyalists in any country live entirely isolated from the population itself. They have friends, they have family members, they have existing relationships that they have to live with in the long term, whether or not the leader stays or goes. In Serbia, when it became obvious that hundreds of thousands of Serbs were descending on Belgrade to demand that Milosevic leave office, police officers started to disobey the order to shoot on demonstrators. When one of them was asked why he did so, he said simply, "I knew my kids would be in the crowd."
So the idea of nonviolent protests comes up throughout modern history, and we owe many societal changes to them. These include those led by people like Mahatma Gandhi, who led civil resistance for India's independence, Martin Luther King Jr., who led the civil rights movement in the US, and Susan B. Anthony, who was an early champion of the women's rights movement.
But what's interesting is that we can now study and quantify exactly what these protests lead to.
Right.
So according to Chenoweth, 3.5%, as we said earlier, is the percentage of a country's population that creates a critical mass of sorts. Mm-hmm. So if you get 3.5% of the population to participate in a nonviolent protest, it has never failed to bring about a change. So this includes movements like the People Power Campaign against the Marcos regime in the Philippines, where in 1986, about 2 million people took to the streets in prayer and protest of the excesses of the government and the Marcos family. There's also the singing revolution in Estonia in the late 80s, where every evening, huge groups of people would participate in singing demonstrations.
I love that.
Yeah, I love the name.
I love the idea of it.
This led to the independence of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And then there was the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003, where their president was ousted after protesters stormed the parliament, holding red roses in their hands.
Aww.
Yeah. And there are others, of course. There's the Brazilian uprising in 1984 and 85, which had 1 million people participating, the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia in 89, which attracted 500,000 people, all of which were nonviolent and all meet that criteria of 3.5% people of the nation participating.
Mm-hmm. And more recently, the presidents of Sudan and Algeria both stepped aside, and this is thanks to peaceful resistance campaigns. So this actually reflects a trend in Africa over the last two decades of moving towards nonviolent rebellions. And these nonviolent rebellions have had a success rate of 58% in overthrowing dictatorships from countries like Burkina Faso, Madagascar, Mali, Tunisia, and Zambia.
But interestingly enough, some relatively large nonviolent protests have also failed. Mm. So, for instance, East Germany's protests against the Communist Party in the 1950s. And this seems to be because they did not get to that 3.5% mark. So, for some numbers, the East Germany protests had 400,000 people or 2% of their population. So, they fell short by. It's an interesting number, isn't it? 3.5%.
Yeah.
And, it does seem like a small number when you look at it like that. But actually raising even that amount of support is not easy.
Yeah.
So if you look at population numbers, let's say in the US, 3.5% comes up to 11 million citizens. Mm-hmm. In the UK, 2.3 million of their citizens. In India, 3.5% is over 45 million people,
right.
Which is more than Malaysian population.
Yeah.
And looking to our shores, 3.5% means having 1.1 million people participating in the movement.
Mm.
And keep in mind that even the highest reported numbers of the Bursay rallies in Kuala Lumpur was only about 500,000.
Yeah. Mm. So it's sort of deceptive when you think 3.5%, but it does require that sort of mass movement for something to happen.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, there are several reasons why nonviolent protests often prove more effective. You know, besides the large number of peoples that are resistant to the idea of violence, there's also the fact that nonviolent protests have more options for participation.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be fit and healthy to participate in civil disobedience or a strike, for example.
Mm.
I mean, these movements also don't require extensive underground movements and planning or weapons. It's easier to spread news of nonviolent movements and through that, win more people over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nonviolent movements also take many forms, you know, from rallies, protests, strikes, sit-ins, walkouts, to even, like you mentioned earlier, Shamila, singing, or just forming human chains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so finally, nonviolent movements are more likely to win the support of the police and military, who are essential to how a country maintains order.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a good point that you don't have to be fit and healthy, for instance, because then you get all walks of life. life. You get the elderly, you get perhaps younger people who are just as invested in the cause as anyone else.
Whereas I think historically, a lot of armed conflict has often relied on young, able-bodied men.
So last year, Dr. Ku Ying Hui, a senior lecturer at University of Malaya's Department of International and Strategic Studies, spoke to us about how a demonstration can be viewed as effective. Here's what she had to say.
I think there's a lot of factors that we can see whether a rally or demonstration can be effective. One factor, of course, refers to the strategies of the movement on whether or not it can, it actually causes massive problems, as in, is it disruptive or to what extent? So looking into this, actually, a lot of researchers have actually shown that non-violent approach has actually managed to contribute more to the effectiveness of a rally. And to link this up with this is that we also have to consider on how is the state reactions towards the rally, how high or to what extent the state repression in managing or facilitating the demonstration. So all this will involve the cost and benefits of certain reactions. So what I'm saying is that the effectiveness of the protest is also can be depends on the manner in which it is being conducted. So in other words, getting into the streets, it's just the first step. So what is really needed is that protesters need to do and continue other works to actually convince the public that their points are valid. So linking to that point, I think a favorable political environment is important, such as whether is the political system are open or do you have support from the political rallies. This idea of political environment is important because protest doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's actually accumulated from the grievances and the injustices that have happened over years or decades. And then the collective actions takes place, then that's where it leads to the demonstration.
Dr. Ku also spoke about the effect that the Bursay rallies had on our local politics.
Since 2007, when the first Bursay rally, we can see the trend of the voters turnout has been between 75% to 85% that we can see in our 2008, 2013 elections and also the 2018 elections. So if we want to tie up the impact of the Bursay, because the Bursay motive is actually to increase the awareness of the importance of voting, the right to vote, and you vote for change. So if I just look at that perspective, Bursay has play a role in terms of the voters' turnout as well.
Yeah, so I suppose while we haven't... I suppose perhaps we haven't required that kind of a mass effect to happen. I think our own sort of experiences with nonviolent demonstrations have proved that they do have the ability to make some kinds of social changes.
Definitely. I think what Dr. Ku said, you know, it's that it is a result of years of or a response of throughout years of grievances or injustices, right? And that and the Bursay rallies, you can see the trend because it took place over there was different iterations that took place over several years, and you could see that momentum building up and the numbers increasing as well.
And I mean, we can. I thought it would actually be interesting to check in on our Twitter poll and kind of see who are some of these, I suppose, leaders of nonviolent movements that most people draw inspiration from.
Yeah, I mean, so we were asking you on Twitter who you think was most inspiring in leading peaceful social change. Gandhi and Martin Luther King each got 40% of the vote, with Susan B. Anthony with 11% of your vote and Dalai Lama with 9%. And no, we have had some responses on social media. Vigneswaran said that if you put this poll in India, it would be Gandhi at 90%. And if you put it in the States, it would be Martin Luther King at 90%. All of them are special in their own way.
Absolutely, yes.
And we have someone who messaged us on WhatsApp.
Yes, so Ashraf actually suggested Malcolm X as someone he would think has generated Change,
yeah, but not non-violent because Malcolm X was not a proponent of peaceful protests and was in fact, no judgment here. It's just that he took the other line of the revolution,
and in fact was often is often painted as the sort of counterpoint to Martin Luther King.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, with the Black Power movement, right? Mm. Yeah.
And I think it is actually quite interesting because when you take someone like Nelson Mandela, for instance, when we look at it from where we are now, mm-hmm. you know, decades after the changes happened, he was one of the first people that came to mind when I was thinking of leaders. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to actually... to when you recall history, that he wasn't completely a proponent of nonviolence.
Yes.
Yeah, and in fact, I think at certain points, he and the ANC were of the opinion that nonviolence is what they should strive for, mm-hmm. but if required, violence could prove to be a tool as well.
Yes.
So that's an interesting sort of dichotomy between other leaders who have consistently, people like Gandhi, who have consistently turned to civil disobedience and strikes rather than turn to violent acts.
And if you think about it, that journey is so much more difficult because it's easier to make that compromise like Nelson Mandela did to say, yes, we prefer nonviolence, but if you need to, you can resort to some armed responses, for instance. But to really stick to your guns, I shouldn't say that, to really stick to the nonviolent path and say, do not respond in that way, that really takes a different kind of mindset. But it's something that I think the people, the rakyat, if you want to call it that, would be more willing to buy into, because if you just look at the Bursay rallies, for instance, the reason that so many people from all walks of life and largely from middle class families, older grandparents, people bringing their like teenage kids and all that, is because they knew that it was geared at being nonviolent, mm-hmm. that it was meant to be a peaceful movement, just asking for certain changes, and that's the thing, that you can get more of a buy-in when people don't fear or the outcome of the movement.
Yeah, I think that also shows how, you know, the idea of revolution has changed over time. Mm-hmm. How, you know, probably last time when people think of revolution, it's something that people may associate violence with, that it's not exactly that you want people you know, your family and friends to go to. Whereas mm-hmm. nowadays, it's become a tool for social change, mm-hmm. where it's not, where people can just, like you say, Shawi, people from all walks of life can just go and voice out their opinion. It doesn't turn violent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a way for people, like, in a democracy, it's a way for people to voice their thoughts.
Yeah, I suppose it doesn't turn violent. It's important to note that generally it doesn't turn violent from the point
the
of the
protesters.
Yes. The violence is often effected by the state.
Yes.
Not in our context necessarily. I'm saying that generally when there is violence in these situations, it's because the regime that's being protested against is trying to strike back.
Yeah, so if you think about the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. For instance, a lot... the conflict came from the response by the authorities.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you can keep the conversation going. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We are also on Facebook. You can check us out at BFM The Bigger Picture. If you missed any part of the show, you can download the podcasts at bfm.my, on the BFM app, and also on Spotify. Coming up at 3 p.m. on Live and Learn, Kelly and Issa will be discussing the findings from the recent State of the World Population Report with UNFPA Malaysia's Marcella Suazo and Sivanandi Tanindran from the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Centre for Women. We leave you now with Revolution by the Beatles, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.